Curse.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, episode 42. Speak and Destroy is a podcast about all things Metallica, and I am your host, Ryan J. Downey. My guest this episode is Dave Brownsound, guitar playing shredder for Sum 41. We are talking all about growing up in Canada and discovering Metallica, his first Metallica riffs, his favorite go-to riffs when he's warming up now, Robert Trujillo, Jason Newsted, Kirk's guitar playing, Lars's drumming, all sorts of fun stuff. And of course, we take a deep dive into MTV icon Metallica, early 2000s event that introduced Rob Trujillo as the new bass player of Metallica, and saw a bunch of artists paying rather dubious homage to the greatest band in the world. Sum 41, who opened the show with a Metallica medley, brought the house down. They were far and away the highlight of the night, other than Metallica themselves, of course. Now, if you listen to the previous episode with Dave's bandmate Derek, where we also discussed that show, you may recall that I was in fact there, as I was a full-time reporter producer for MTV News in that era, working out of the California office, and that show taped on the Universal Studios lot here in Southern California. My buddy Rob, who runs Metal Injection, sent me an email yesterday wondering why the MTV Icon Metallica show was the only MTV Icon show that had ever happened. Well, in fact, as I noted when I replied to him, there was a Janet Jackson MTV Icon 2 years prior to that. Aerosmith episode with a lineup that was just about as confusing as the Metallica lineup, but did also include Sum 41, backing up Ja Rule and Nelly. That 2001 Janet Jackson event featured Outkast doing, of course, Miss Jackson, Destiny's Child, Macy Gray, NSYNC, Pink, Usher, Maya, Janet herself, and Buck Cherry. Even weirder and sort of more awful was that Aerosmith episode, which despite having Sum 41 as the backing band for Nelly, Ja Rule, and DJ Clue, featured Pink doing Janie's Got a Gun, Shakira doing Dude Looks Like a Lady, Kid Rock doing some terrible medley, Train doing Dream On, and Papa Roach doing Sweet Emotion. The choices for the 2003 MTV Icon Metallica were even more strange, perhaps. We had Stain doing Nothing Else Matters, Avril Lavigne doing Fuel, Snoop Dogg doing Sad But True, Korn doing One, which you might think would have been cool, but actually really wasn't. And of course, the worst offenders of the night, Limp Bizkit, slogging their way through a terrible, muddled, edited version of Welcome Home Sanitarium. The night finished with Metallica doing a medley of Hit the Lights, Inner Sandman, Blacken, Creeping Death, Battery, and Frantic. But certainly the best MTV Icon show was what appears to have been the final one, which took place in 2004. And of course, it looks like it only aired in the UK and Europe. That was MTV Icon The Cure, which was hosted by Marilyn Manson. Blink-182 opened the show with a couple of Cure songs, including one where Robert Smith himself guested. Now, remember, this is 2004, so this was kind of the dark emo phase of Blink-182. AFI did a pretty faithful version of Just Like Heaven, backed by my good friend Marta of Bleeding Through on keyboards. A band called Razorlight from the UK did Boys Don't Cry. And my favorite performance of the night, the Deftones doing If Only Tonight We Could Sleep. The Cure played three songs, including Friday I'm in Love. I could, and perhaps will, do an entire episode about MTV Icon Metallica, as I have a lot of memories that didn't come up in either conversation with the Sum 41 dudes, despite each of these episodes being roughly an hour long and filled with great stories. I have some personal recollections from the day of rehearsals the day before, as well as some stuff that happened the night of the show. If that's something you think you'd be interested in hearing, let me know. Maybe shoot me a message on social media or shoot an email to speakanddestroy@superherohq.com. Please, I'm going to ask you, and I'll make it really quick, if you haven't done so already, go into Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to Speak and Destroy and leave a nice little review and a 5-star rating. Those really do help with people discovering the podcast, with the overall visibility of the show, and it just makes me feel a little twinge of self-validation when I read the lovely things you have to say. So here it is, my conversation with Dave Brownsound of Sum 41. This is Speak and Destroy.
Thank you.
I was a reporter producer at MTV News, you know, in the early 2000s. So I was actually working in the Santa Monica office when MTV Icon Metallica took place. So I was there for rehearsals the day before. And then, you know, one of the things that stands out to me about that, and obviously we'll go backwards, but just to talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
It, you know, almost every, gosh, not even almost every, I mean, in retrospect, every band that performed there was kind of a, huh, what? In terms of a Metallica tribute show. And I think there's something about maybe Sum 41 having, you know, maybe the expectations, the bar was pretty low and you're kind of underdogs. And then you're opening the show and you just destroyed. I mean, and you in particular were up there in your Bad Brain shirt and just crushed it. And without, you know, getting into the nuances or calling out any names or anything, it was by far, far and away the best performance of that night and the most, you know, the only, in my opinion, the only one that was really worthy of the occasion.
Thanks, man. Thank you. I mean, yeah, I mean, we're all Metallica fans, right? So that's huge. That's a massive compliment.
It's also the one that's memorable now, you know, for all the right reasons that you still remember when I think about that show. I think about, you know, the Sum 41 medley. So let's take it back to the beginning. And what were some of your first, you know, the first kind of songs you heard around the house or musical people in your family or any kind of, you know, those early encounters where you realized, hey, music is a really important thing to me and feels like it's going to be important to my life?
Actually, this story I've gotten to tell quite a bit, which is pretty cool. I ended up getting a basket of CDs from my uncle, and I just like freshly got my first CD player with like speakers that I thought sounded cool. It was like a neat little graphic 5-band EQ on the unit too. So I was all pumped up to get into the world of CDs because they were brand new at the time. And he came over and he's like, yo, nephew, check this out. So he just hands me this basket and it's just filled with like straight up like classic rock CDs. Tons of stuff all the way from like Led Zeppelin to Foreigner to Genesis to Metallica. And when I first picked up a CD out of there that really caught my eye, it was Led Zeppelin 3. So I put it in, and that particular pressing, The Immigrant Song, is number one. And it just hit me real hard because it scared the shit out of me.
Yes. Yes.
So I heard the first vocal, and just like shut, like press stop. And I was like, no, 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 that's way too evil to be listening to. And then, you know, eventually I kept on going back. And you know, as an 8-year-old kid, it left a heavy impression on me. And eventually, as I was going through the CDs, I came across Master of Puppets, which was a CD that my cousin had given me to borrow. Probably about 2-3 months prior to getting this basket of CDs. And he was just in love with Cliff Burton being a bass player.
Wow, yeah.
And just hearing Orion, hearing Master of Puppets, hearing how fast they played Damage Incorporated and stuff like that, that record really left a lasting impression on me. And from there, of course, I discovered Ride the Lightning and Kill 'Em All. But my first real solid experience with Metallica would have been Master of Puppets record.
Wow, and about how old were you at that time?
I would have been around 8 or 9 years old.
Wow. So, yeah, that's killer. That's killer.
I would guess more towards 8, but because Puppets was 86, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, so yeah, around then.
That's so killer, and to get and to have people in your family that are turning you onto that so young is amazing. And
yeah,
so,
they were a rhythm section combo. It was younger cousin was a bass player and his older brother was a drummer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They would play at the local pizza place all the time. They were, first they were a band called Shade, and then I think they changed their name to something more metal like Nemesis.
Nemesis is a pretty great metal name.
Yeah.
Now, and now if you called your band that, it would be like Nemesis, but like without the vowels or something.
I know. Unfortunately, kids in the hall, they called their band Armada or something like that.
Yeah,
so now it kind of falls in that category.
You're falling in love with this music. You're discovering Zeppelin. Master of Puppets is making its impact. Where did picking up a guitar come in?
An actual guitar came a little bit later than when I first fell in love with it. When I first really remember playing guitar, it was me unscrewing the leg from a chalkboard.
Nice.
that my parents had bought for me. And it was just like straight, and then the legs V'd out, so it looked like a flying V, like the pictures of Jimi Hendrix and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I would pick that up, turn on a record, like just put it on and pretend I was playing guitar. But when I actually started learning, would have been it probably would have been around 13, 14 years old. I went to one of those pizza place shows that I was talking about that my cousins at Nemesis would play. And I picked up the rhythm guitar player's Ibanez. I believe it was a Silver Cadet. And he just came up to me. He was like, "Hey, do you want to learn how to play guitar?" I was like, "Yeah." And he's like, "Okay, I'll get you started." And he tapped out some stuff for me. I was garbage. I never learned properly, put it down. And then I ended up at my cousin's house, the bass player I was talking about. His name's Vaughn.
Mm-hmm.
And Vaughn was playing Battletoads. And they had this kind of Strat copy called a Stinger.
Uh-huh.
And I put it on my lap. I started kind of playing around on it. My cousin pressed pause on Battletoads. He came to me. He's like, "Yo, man, you don't play with the guitar like that. Like, you tilt it up." Like, I had it down on my lap like Jeff Healey, right?
I was going to say, you're like, "I don't know, man. I just saw this movie Roadhouse." That's
yeah,
how
exactly.
This is how the guy had it.
Yeah, like missing throats everywhere, and the guy played guitar like this. And, so he tilted it up, and he sat me down with a magazine, and it was one of the tabs in this magazine, which happened to be called Guitar Magazine,
mm-hmm.
Was this song by a band called Anthrax, and it was Caught in a Mosh.
Oh, nice.
So the first riff I ever really learned and committed to was actually Caught in a Mosh by Anthrax.
That is so awesome. What a great...
Oh, man.
I mean, you were immediately then caught in a mosh.
Oh, yeah. Oh, dude, my cousin, like, he just assimilated me immediately. Like, there was no wasting time with him.
Man, a couple of years ago, I was at NAMM and was kind of in a hallway. I mean, I guess you would call it backstage, but it was, you know, I was with an artist, and we were trying to get from one area of the place to another, and then there were like three other groups of handlers and artists doing the same thing. We all sort of converge, and we're in this like pile for a minute, and
yeah.
I look over, and one of the guys I'm brushing shoulders with is Scott Ian, and everyone that's colliding with each other is silent, so it's like it's all happening quietly, and I just go, "Man, it's kind of like we're all caught in a mosh."
Oh, geez.
And he didn't laugh.
Oh, no.
Everyone else laughed, but he didn't laugh. I was like, "Oh, man."
Think about it, though, man. Like, how many times he's probably been, has been quoted or
indeed.
Something else? Or
indeed. Yeah.
Somebody's been like, "Hey, man, quit being antisocial," or something like that, right?
Yeah, or he's like, "Yeah, that was funny. Not." I bet you think you're the man. Okay.
So, right?
dude, yeah, that's a great first riff. What was your first Metallica riff that you learned?
First Metallica riff would have been one. I ended up picking up that piece of paper that my cousin's rhythm guitar player had tabbed out for me. And he was like, "Listen, if you learn this riff, you'll be good at guitar." And I was like, "All right." He's like, "You know, Caught in a Mosh is all good and well, but, you know, use that piece of paper that I gave you." So he tabbed out the clean section for one, and then he tabbed out the heavy section, the really, really heavy section, not the chorus. So it took me a while to really grasp that, because I just couldn't get the speed up, and my hands would just crap out as soon as I tried to even get that fast. But that would have been the first Metallica riff.
And what's great about that song as a first song is it really sort of has it all. You know, it covers, it runs the gamut from like that clean part to, like you said, the chorus and the verses, and then the super gnarly breakdown at the end and super fast stuff and the solos. It's like, yeah, you could learn so many different shades of rock guitar playing from that one song.
Oh man, yeah. And then from there, it just went like it just kind of took off from there. I couldn't get enough, especially with a band like Metallica, who it's just bad boy riff after bad boy riff. Like mm-hmm. I would sit there and just learn, rewind. And I gotta say, like, I would probably like blame them for the fact that the rewind button on my CD player went.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so they kind of owe me one.
I was just discussing this with a friend of mine earlier today, how many different times we've bought each record and how many different formats. You know, like, oh, I own Master
right?
Puppets on cassette and then on CD, and I also got vinyl, and then I had another yeah. vinyl when I lost that one, and then I, yeah, and,
yeah.
then iTunes, and, then, like, then the collector's yeah. edition, and yeah.
Oh, they digitally remastered it? I don't yeah. know what that means. I'll grab that too.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know what that means. I might not even open it, but I want it. That's killer.
Totally.
So when you put on your guitar right now and you're warming up in the green room or something, or you're sound checking, do you have some go-to Metallica riffs that are just likely to come out of your hands?
Dyer's Eve, every day.
Oh, nice. Nice.
I got to play Dyer's Eve, just the intro riff,
mm-hmm.
The verse, and then sometimes I'll play the breakdown riff. But that's such a good one to warm up to. Good precise picking and quick movements with the left hand.
Yeah, and man, the way that transition, the way that To Live Is to Die fades in, and all of a sudden it's like surprise.
Yeah, right.
It's so magical. And that was a song that they didn't play live for a long time. There was a period where they didn't, and then they've come back to it in more recent years, which is a real treat for me because I think it's my. It may not be the best song. I always find there's a distinction between best and favorite, but it is my favorite song from that album.
Yeah, it's such a good song. And I remember we were recording the record Chuck,
uh-huh.
and Metallica was playing the Forum, and so we were at Sound City at the time. Is what the name of the studio was.
Yeah, Legendary
and,
Sound City. That's the, for people listening who don't know, that's the studio that Dave Grohl did the documentary about.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we ended up going to the show that night, and it was incredible because they actually played Dyer's Eve that night, and they were just like, yeah, we don't play this one that often. And they have this approach to playing, which is amazing. You don't go and see... like overdone theatrics and obvious tracks being played. It's like they messed the song up and they started it again.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And we all just appreciated it because it was such a good time.
That accessibility and that they really, I think that's part of the spirit of punk that they brought to metal, was bringing it back down to earth for the rest of us, you know, like, oh, these guys are dressed like me and all my friends, and it's real and raw and urgent sounding, and it's not all pomposity and, you know, Dungeons and Dragons and stuff. And to, you know, speaking of Dyer's Eve, something I realized about that song just kind of recently, lyrically, it was really the bridge between the first four Metallica albums and then the Black Album and everything they did in the 90s, because it's, you know, it was a song that was very autobiographical for Hetfield and very super visceral and personal. And
yeah,
then,
man.
You know,
yeah.
That's
as
the kind of stuff he got
fan,
into.
Yeah, as a fan of Hetfield, I mean, that guy is why I wear black wristbands on stage, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
watching, like, listening to him over the years and now being able to watch him a lot more thanks to things like YouTube and social media and stuff like that.
Sure.
It's been cool for me. I know some people have their reservations about it, but I am glad that he seems to be in a good spot.
Hell yeah, absolutely.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
and
I mean
the new Metallica records are coming from a place of love and just a love for the music and the craft.
Are you alive?
Right.
How
exactly.
does it feel to be alive? Yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I love getting to sort of grow with an artist as a fan, and you know, through all the changes and growing pains. And you know, one of the things I always note about Metallica, and it comes up on this podcast a lot, whether you love the band or used to love the band or hate the band, anytime they do something, whenever they put a record out, you know about it because everyone in any area of the rock community is aware of it and has an opinion. And that in and of itself speaks volumes to me. Even with the haters, it's like, man, you're still talking about them, though. Like, you still can't resist the magnetic pull of a new Metallica record being out and having to say something about it.
And that's I mean, getting specific, like, we just did some stuff with AP, some guitar solo stuff. And we, you know, man, like, I hear some people, you know, getting down on Kirk and stuff like that, but at the same time, those same people talking that bullshit will be able to pick out one of his solos in the air from 100 yards. You know what I mean?
Exactly. So, and probably, and especially the guitar players that talk that bullshit, a lot of them probably were directly or indirectly influenced by him in the very beginning. Yeah, I did
absolutely.
I host a Q&A series at the Musicians Institute here in LA about once a month, and I call it Inside the Actor Studio for Bands. And I had I had Joe Satriani there a few months ago, and in the YouTube comments, it's a bunch of people like, oh, Kirk's guitar teacher, huh? Like, he needs to take more lessons, or just talking shit. And it's like, dude, Kirk Hammett is a fucking wizard. Like, he, you know, and he has such a, you know, let's set aside technique and all of that for a minute, and just like you were saying, to have a signature sound, to be identifiable. I mean, there are few lead guitar players doing solos where you immediately go, oh, that's that guy. You know, it's like, you know, Megadeth is another one for me, where when it's Mustaine and Chris Poland, and when it's Mustaine and Marty Friedman, you can tell, you know, listening to Hangar 18, you can go, there's Mustaine, there's Friedman, there's Mustaine, there's Friedman, you know, like,
you know,
and it's like, there's not a lot of metal guitar players, you know, Kirk, the guys in Slayer, Tom G. Warrior, Tom G. Warrior, not a great guitar player. I recognize Tom G. Warrior playing guitar, you know?
Of course. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. To find our own voice as guitar players, that's probably the biggest challenge, unless, you know, you're a player that's just born with it.
Yeah. And I think those magicians really stand out when they can really make a guitar speak. I mean, when you think about how often you hear about Kirk and the wah pedal, it's like, think about what a feat that is to have a piece of gear like that. So, you know, like just so like connected to you, like, you know what I mean? If I hear a wah pedal, I think of Kirk Hammett. If I see Kirk Hammett, I think of wah pedals. You know, it's like, that's an achievement in and of itself. It's like Hetfield and the Explorer, you know?
Yeah. And who didn't, as a guitar player, when they first got their wah pedal? You know what I mean? Well, maybe there are guitar players that didn't care for the wah pedal when they got it, but as soon as I got mine, it unlocked a whole new world for me. And it's actually on the new Sum 41 record. It's a massive part of the solos on that because of a huge influence from guys like Kirk, guys like Carey, guys like Jeff, you know, guys like Holt. Like, it's all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah. I had Gary Holt on the podcast a little while back. You know, he was saying, and he talks about this in the new Murder in the Front Row documentary as well.
Yeah.
He was saying that to this day, the way that he holds a pick, you know, the way that he plays a power chord, Kirk Hammett literally taught him that. Like, he showed him how to play guitar. And then at some point, you know, handed the keys to the family car of Exodus over to him. And I think that's something, by the way, about that documentary that's really great, is Kirk is such a humble, soft-spoken, kind of mild-mannered seeming guy. He doesn't toot his own horn a lot. And as much as, you know, James and Lars and Mustaine and a certain group of people are rightly credited with pioneering thrash metal, people don't realize that, like, Kirk was the leader of Exodus up until the time he left. And he was driving the creative train and putting the band together and, you know, bringing the influences in. And he was, you know, a essential ingredient to that whole movement happening in the Bay. And that's, like, why they got him, you know, like, that's why they chose him. He wasn't just a random person, you know.
Absolutely. And I mean, those guys, they still are playing. Like, we just, I think it was 2018 or 2017.
Mm-hmm.
I literally just watched them on a festival stage.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
So they're still ripping, man. It's really cool. And we had the opportunity to, we had it put out to us by an agent. It would have been around 2003, 2004, but mm-hmm. we played San Francisco. And we got the offer to have Exodus come and play the show. They were like, yo, listen, we're all from here.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We'll totally jam down with you. We were like, what? I'll be honest. I was the only one that is, like, nerdy enough with Metallica to know about Exodus.
Sure, sure.
Right? So I was like, yo, dude, we got to do this. This has got to happen. So we ended up having a show with Exodus, which was, like, massive for me.
That's so killer. Yeah, my little journalist trick to the first opportunity I ever had to interview Kirk, it was when I was at MTV. This was probably 2002, maybe 3. It was whatever year the Johnny Cash Hurt video was up for Video of the Year at the VMAs. And Kurt Loder had conducted what I believe ended up being the last interview with Johnny Cash for piece that ran during the MTV News pre-show before the VMAs. And so he had, you know, the Cash interview, and then a couple of other producers, myself included, were interviewing other artists about Johnny Cash for a piece that ran with that piece. So I interviewed Chris Cornell, which was amazing, about Johnny Cash, and I interviewed James and Kirk together. And what my little, you know, build trust with the artist right away maneuver was in my first question. I referenced Kirk being in Exodus and you just,
oh, nice.
You know, and it's like, yeah, it's like 2002, 2003. I'm a guy from MTV. I have like some shitty faux hawk, you know, I'm there to talk about Johnny Cash and the VMAs. And, so just immediately like drop that little Exodus nugget in. You could see both of them kind of sit up in their chairs a little like, oh, this guy isn't like just some joker. Like, this might be a cool conversation. And that's like,
right?
That little moment is like everything, you know? I'm just like, you guys have no idea.
With going back to Icons, we ended up going to the dress rehearsal because everybody had to go play. And I feel like it was kind of like an audition because we ended up going up. We got the call. So our wrangler took us to the stage, set up, and we played it. Played the medley, you know, Bells into Sandman into Master of Puppets solo and out. And I got off stage and I was just like, I can't believe, like, that childhood dream where, you know, I sat in my room and pretended I was playing in Metallica.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of coming true in a weird roundabout way where I have to play it for Metallica.
Totally.
Right?
No pressure.
We're down on the floor, and our sound guy is kind of playing back what we just did. We're kind of critiquing the sounds, tones, this and that. And this guy beside me, he's just like, huh, I thought that was us. And I look up, and it's like, holy shit, it's James.
Holy
right?
shit, no way.
And I'm, yeah, dude, and I am looking up because he's way taller than me.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm like, oh, hey, man, how's it going? He's like, hey.
That's
well, yeah,
badass.
And then, you know, we played for them. There were smiles, and then we ended up getting to hang out with them after at the bar and stuff like that. And, you know, we got to meet the actual band that we, you know, fell in love with. And at that time, Rob was fresh in. So it was just like,
I want to say that was maybe, you know, the public unveiling of Rob in Metallica.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I mean, who out of my circle didn't grow up with Suicidal and Infectious?
Of course.
Like,
of course.
You know what I mean? And then, of course, you know, he was the Whiskey Warlord playing for Ozzy.
Yes.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, and then all of a sudden Newstead's in Ozzy's band. What?
Oh, dude, and then I went and saw that show after they did the trade, right?
Uh-huh.
And somebody had sent a rumor about how, like Newstead was fed up or he was mad with Sharon or something like that. And it was super weird. So you got, like, stage left, Zach is going wild.
Mm-hmm. No pun intended.
At the back, Borden is killing it. Yeah, no puns intended at all. And then Ozzy, like, he's going so hard that every jump looks like his last jump, right? And then you look over to Newstead, and his hair is, like, tied back. He's wearing, like, a weird shirt. You know, not, like, weird, like weird designs or anything like that. It's just, like, a shirt that didn't really fit the mood.
Right. I know exactly what you mean, yeah.
Yeah, it was like the bathrobe of like concert shirts. Like if somebody yeah. would just come out in a bathrobe.
More like what he was wearing in a year and a half in the life when he's in the studio on like day 29.
Yeah. 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 That would be a perfect comparison. and he had like he was reading the music. Like he was just he had a stand set up with sheets and he'd be playing bass and turning pages and it was like, yo, what's happening over there? I actually heard that it was a almost like a protest.
Mm, gotcha.
Something to do with he was unhappy with management and how the band was being handled. So and plus, Jason Newsted's he's a badass guitar player. You know what I mean?
Oh, of course. I mean,
badass bass player.
And nobody works harder. He works so hard at his instrument and performance. Like, you know,
exactly.
Yeah.
And if you've ever met him, he's a fucking good dude.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. So something was up because, like, when I saw it going down, I was like, my immediate thought wasn't, oh, what's wrong with Jason? I was like, who's doing something to Jason?
right.
Because yeah, he's got that your boy attitude, you know, went and jammed with Voivod, right?
Yeah. And in fact, there was a big, and this could have something to do with the atmosphere you're describing. You know, he was very much on the Voivod train. Like that was his new band, you know? And
yeah.
When he joined Ozzy's band, they went out on Ozfest and Voivod was on the second stage. And I got the impression, I interviewed Jason actually at Ozfest, and I got the impression that it was sort of, that was kind of the trade, you know, like not that he didn't love Ozzy and, you know, love those songs and everything. Of course he did, but that it was really more about doing the Voivod thing and getting Voivod the hookup on Ozfest via playing in Ozzy. And what's interesting is even rewinding a little bit further back, I actually did the Ozzy introduces Jason interview. There was a reporter, I was there for MTV. Ooh. And then there was a reporter from CNN there and it was at a rehearsal space in, I think Burbank. And it was Mike Borden and Zach and Ozzy and Newstead. And they were, you know, we each had a little camera crew there and it was like, Ozzy and Jason are going to talk to CNN for a few minutes. They're going to talk to us for a few minutes. We're all going to film B-roll of them running through some songs and that'll be that. And of course, me being the massive Metallica fan that I am, I was, you know, yeah, I'm a huge Ozzy and Sabbath fan, of course, and Faith No More, and you know everyone in that room, awesome. But I'm Metallica, yeah. Like the band for me, so I'm super psyched about meeting Newstead. So there was a moment. There's a little tiny bathroom in that rehearsal space with like two urinals and a stall, right? And I go in there and I use the urinal, and then I'm washing my hands, and then Newstead comes out of the stall and he's washing his hands right next to me, and I'm like, I'm going to meet him in like 5 minutes and do the interview. But I mean, shit, we're shoulder to shoulder right now. And so I was just
right.
Like, I was just like, hey man, I'm Ryan Downey from MTV. We're, you know, we're going to interview. He's like, oh, hey bro. And I was like, just, you know, before we do the interview and stuff, I just want to tell you, like, I'm, you know, I'm a fan from the Flotsam and Jetsam days. And I loved all the Arizona thrash bands, Atrophy and Sacred Reich. And he's like, oh, right on. And I was like, yeah. And Voivod's actually one of my favorite bands of all time. Like, to mention Hatros is like, that's the record for me. And he's like listening and nodding. And then we both finish washing our hands and he goes, that's all killer, man. Do me a favor, bro. When we're out there with Oz, don't mention Flotsam or Voivod or any of that stuff. Just talk about Ozzy. I was like, Sure. Yeah, no, of course. So that was even
Man.
whatever clue that is to whatever. That was kind of a little moment where I was like, all right, this is like a means to an end sounds more calculated. I don't know if that's the right phrase, but
I mean, who knows? Who knows? Like,
yeah.
you have a massive player like Newstead coming in to the camp, right? And maybe the camp just wanted to make it known, like, listen, you're working for us, and this
Right.
is how it goes.
Right. And that's always a hard thing when you get somebody of a certain stature in another established act, because
Yeah.
you know, it's kind of like when Portnoy was in Avenged Sevenfold. Like, Portnoy is such a awesome, great dude and such a legend of the drums himself, and then Avenged has such a unique identity, and there was a little bit of a feeling of like, oh, it's Avenged plus Portnoy, as opposed to just like, it's Avenged and here's their new drummer. So I understand that
Yeah.
there's kind of that difficulty sometimes of that not quite fitting together the way that you would want it to. So who knows? I can only imagine too, it's like for Newstead, I mean, that's coming out of a 14-year marriage and then going into a new marriage like immediately,
Yeah,
you know.
I
So
guess so. Yeah, that's true.
that had to be a rough transition, and I think it worked out for everybody the way that it should. He seems happy doing his art, and he's been doing his acoustic stuff lately, and so
Oh yeah, man. And no matter what, he's gonna stay musical for sure. But
yeah. And he's always going to be a
I
part of
mean,
that band's legacy and that, but you know, and the reissues they've been doing and the merch that they have and the, you know, the riff in Blackened, and like, you know, he's still, his essence is still going to permeate and be part of that band, even while Rob's out there holding it down and contributing in his way.
yeah, man.
What was your first Metallica show?
First show would have actually been the Forum.
Oh, rat.
Like,
Okay.
I did not get to see Metallica until 2003, when they came after the Black Album, which would have been the first time I would have been actually able to go to the concert. I kind of got priced out, and because everyone that wanted to go wanted to go to Cox Coliseum and Montreal at the same time. So we were, and Cox Coliseum's out in Hamilton, and it was on the Metal Roses tour.
Oh, all right.
Yeah. So it was super, yeah, I had a couple friends that were there for the actual mishap with the pyro.
That's what I was just about to ask. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they said, like, it was insane what happened.
Man.
Like they were wild. And we ended up actually working with Aquarius Records, who had people that would bring. So it was owned by a guy named Donald K. Donald, who had a like kind of like a, I wouldn't even say a counterpart. It was just like an equal. Like, you get the two of these guys together, Donald K. Donald and Terry Flood, and they just make shit happen. So, like, thanks to them, like, the Stones were launched in Canada.
Oh, wow.
You know what I mean? Yeah. So thanks to them, stuff like the Metal Roses tour came through Montreal, and they got the show, and they had to handle that whole thing, like the riots and everything like that.
Oh,
And like,
man.
yeah. And man, I cannot tell all the stories because they are just so fucking wild.
And the Statue of Limitations probably still isn't up.
You know what? You know what? Donald still carries an element of danger to him. So yeah, I'll keep quiet on some of those stories.
Yeah, I always think about that thing in the VH1 Behind the Music where I think it's Newstead who's like, yeah, and Guns N' Roses could have come out, played a blistering, 3-hour set and saved the day, but nope. And then the
Nope,
riot.
we will not be undercut.
Yeah, exactly. So Icon was in 2003 as well. So was that Forum show before or after that?
You know what? That would have been after that. So that would have been right around the time that we were doing, like, we were tracking Chuck. So that the fourth release.
Yeah, talking to Derek about how I mentioned to him how you guys have had the opportunity to record at a lot of legendary studios. You mentioned Sound City, but you guys have been to a bunch of cool places over the course of the band. And then these last two records have been made primarily at Derek's studio, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, he'll track the drums at his place. And then for Order Declined, he just put the guitars out to us. Was just like, hey, check this out. This is the tempo. This is the feel. And we just got up, you know, went to our studio suites. Like, I have a suite in my house where I just run an older version of Pro Tools and throw him a DI, and he can reamp through all the legendary amps he's got at his place.
Oh, right.
Yeah, so it was amazing because there was no pressure as far as time constraints. So we could just sit there, and I could literally, like just go deep into the track, really dig in, get the story. There were some, there's like the basis of some lyrics,
mm-hmm.
in the stems that he sent us too, which are tracks that are grouped together so that, we can reference them and play along to them.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was off. It was the best time I've had recording guitars, thanks to the lack of pressure and thanks to the ease of just like waking up, making a cup of coffee and going downstairs and playing guitar.
Yeah. And you're in there by yourself, so you can also kind of self edit and, you know, get the
takes
you're comfortable with. And yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, because of time constraints, sometimes you'll have to, you know, go and like, oh, okay, this part's out of tune, so, you know, do it again. But the whole time I can just be like, you know what? I'm just going to do the whole thing over again.
Yeah.
So like,
who will ever know? Nobody's here. Yeah.
Exactly. So there could be still, depending on what he did with the record after he got it, there could still be like one take performances on that record, you know?
Yeah, and Derek was also saying that it's nice for him not to have the, you know, he was saying at a studio, there's always something going on, like somebody's always fiddling with something or needs to go somewhere or needs to do something. And you know, there's a lot of waiting around and just a lot of hurry up and wait. And yeah, being able to do this at your own pace is just such a great luxury of the modern tools. And then, of course, the experience that you guys have now versus when you're starting.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, now I can think about, you know, relating back to recording that guitar track and my, you know, my stepson coming down and be like, what's the song you're playing, Davey? You know, or the new Sum 41 song. Oh, I really like it. Then he'll go back to playing Fortnite.
I love it. That is awesome. So you guys got the call about doing the Icon show, and you being certainly not the only Metallica fan in the band, but arguably the biggest. What was your, you know, how did you find out about that, and what was your immediate reaction to it?
So with us, we ended up signing to Island Def Jam. So the story kind of begins then. And mm-hmm. One of our A&Rs was a MTV legend, Lewis Largent.
Ah, okay, yeah.
Right. So Lewis had a friend that was doing a lot of production, a lot of shows for MTV, Jesse Ignatovich.
I remember I didn't know Jesse, but he worked like two floors up from me.
Oh, dude, Jesse was such a good human being to us, and like I do truly think that the chemistry between our two A&Rs, Rob Stevenson, Lewis Largent, and Jesse, like there was a lot of great stuff that we were able to do with MTV because of that trio.
That's awesome.
And this was one of the ones where it was like it was a no-brainer. They were like, do you want to do this? And we were like, of course, there's no question. So Jesse pitched the idea to us, and we just officially were like, yeah, I mean, we already said yes. You didn't have to go through all this. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we came up with the idea of, like, you know, we'd like to do a medley, and then Metallica came back with the idea of, why don't we walk out to your medley?
Oh, my gosh.
And we were like, let me get back to you. Yes. Well, so... And it ended up that the first the first version of the medley, Sandman, was a little bit shorter. But that was the song that Metallica wanted to walk out to. So there was like a back and forth with Metallica too, which, you know, added some pressure to the moment of like writing the medley. And then we had to like practice the medley and sound checks, and we were recording it, checking it back to see if we were playing it properly. And then, you know, the day comes after the dress rehearsal, and you know, we're sitting up there, and I've got my Bad Brains team. I remember looking up into the crowd, and somebody actually grabbed a picture of it, and that is literally a picture of me looking into the crowd being like, this is one of the most insane moments of my life. I can't believe it's come to this.
Yeah.
I better not fuck this up. And Cohen on the other side was having an experience where he's like, cool, I hope this wah pedal works. I hope this distortion pedal works. Oh, what's that guy doing? And just this fucking tough-ass Metallica fan looks Cohen in the eyes, points at him, and then makes the neck-cutting thing across his neck with his finger while mouthing the words, don't fuck up.
that's actually, you know, at the time, I'm sure it was horrifying. In retrospect, it's badass.
Right?
So, knowing how hard you guys fucking brought it, like that would be scary if you guys did fuck up.
trust me, man. Trust me. And we were both there. Like, everybody was involved to get their performance right, which is, you know, which is what the special deserves because of what that band's done for all of us. But it was like, oh, man, it was hairy. We were lucky to get away with one pass of it. And yeah, we actually we were playing it we went into Sirius XM not too long ago and rehashed it for them.
Oh, cool. Is that is that out there somewhere?
I don't know if it's out yet, but it should be coming out eventually.
Well, you know what makes me really excited about that is that I mentioned this to Derek. I found somewhere, I couldn't tell you what year it was from, but at some point in the last few years, it was Derek doing a solo show at Lucky Strike Bowling in Hollywood, and Zumo, who I think is just an incredible drummer and a super nice guy, he was playing drums, and they did the Metallica medley, and I was telling Derek, like, dude, I would love to hear you guys do that. it just sounded so good with Frank doing those drum parts, and we got to talking about how, you know, and again, going back to the thing you were saying about Kirk, Lars is one of those drummers where, say what you want, but you can't cover a Metallica song without doing the proper fills. Whereas a lot of rock songs in general, if you have the tempo right and the general feel, you can kind of do whatever. But if you're covering Sad But True, like, you got to do every one of those fills or we're going to notice and it's going to sound weird. You know, right? And that says a lot about a drummer.
Have you seen this YouTube channel where this guy, he talks about how he's going to Larsify tracks?
No.
Okay, it's this drummer, and I don't know if he's, like, trolling or what, but he'll take songs like Don't Stop Believing, and he'll be like, he Larsifies them. And whether or not he's joking around and trying to be funny, I really like the shit he's doing. And I'm like, yeah, man, Lars actually would play it like that. It's fucking rad.
I gotta check it out.
Yeah, man, and they're our band. They're down to earth. I mean, he got into some trouble with the Napster thing, but even mm-hmm. he's quick to admit, like, you know, he made a mistake. But I think that hit him as far as people making fun of him as a drummer.
Absolutely.
I feel like that has more to do with it than his actual drumming. Because,
absolutely,
you know, listen to Kill 'Em All and tell me that isn't a badass record.
And the Napster thing, and I've said this on this podcast before, so I'll try to be brief for recurring listeners' sake. He really only made one wrong turn in there, which was when Napster said, well, we don't know. We can't take all this stuff down. I mean, people are putting it up. Like, I mean, I guess if you told us who it is, and he was like, all right, and then he brought all this document. That was the only mistake, because that was the moment where it looked like Metallica was going after their fans. Everything else about it and everything else about the arguments that they made, You know, Jamie Josta sells a shirt on his website that just says Lars was right. I think it's, you know,
That's awesome.
and again, I've said this on the podcast before, so I'll say it real quick to you. But if you go on YouTube, I'm going to go, you gave me some YouTube homework. I'm going to go find that Larsify guy. You go on YouTube, find this Charlie Rose episode from early 2000s. The guests are Chuck D and Lars, and they're debating Napster and the internet. And Chuck D, love him, tons of respect. He's an icon, super intelligent, great, talented. Everything Lars says comes true. Everything Chuck says was wrong. So,
wow.
It's really interesting to watch now with the hindsight of history, you know?
That's true.
Yeah, and Lars is the bad guy in the interview, and Chuck's kind of the hero. And then you watch it now, and you're like, oh, but Lars is right about everything he's saying, and Chuck was way off.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
So, yeah, I agree with you. I think that that's, you know, people that criticize Lars, a lot of it comes from that place, from that moment. And he's, dude, nobody makes fun of themselves like those guys. Like, you know, they're as in on the joke, whatever the joke may be, as anyone. You know, a couple days ago, they posted on Instagram that it was the anniversary of Saint Anger, and it said in the caption, everyone's favorite, Saint Anger. So it's like, they know. You know?
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And, dude, speaking of that record,
yeah,
like, that record, I fully understand why it happened.
Oh, for sure, and I'm glad it did. It had to, you know?
Yeah, me too, absolutely, man. Like, everybody around, like, I've been in a situation like that where everyone around you is just like, yeah, that's great. Mm-hmm. Nobody's telling you the truth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the band is going through personal issues, like, we've been there. So watching that documentary for me was more like, holy shit. Like, they actually let the world in on this part of what goes on. Right.
And the original idea was like, oh, we'll do a couple of weeks of like a little making of EPK thing.
Yeah.
And then to really, part of the power of that movie is that it speaks to people who have never been in a band but have been in some other type of creative partnership, you know, and then understand, and of course everyone who's been in a band, but even Joe Berlinger, one of the two directors on that, wrote a book about the making of the movie and all this stuff that was happening in his relationship with his co-director, the late Bruce Sanofsky, was kind of running parallel and mirroring what was happening within Metallica. And like, it, you know, and it's just, it's fascinating when you see how people from different walks of life can relate to that. And you know, what's also interesting about the Icon thing is Some Kind of Monster wasn't out yet. And then of course we see retroactively in Some Kind of Monster that the Icon event coming together was what finally pushed them over the cliff to get a new bass player. Because they were like, okay, we're going to do this show. We need a bass player. Who's it going to be? Let's have auditions. So, yeah, it's such a unique and strange sort of moment, yet important moment in their history that you guys were able to play a part in and kick off. I mean, introduce them. It's amazing.
Yeah, it was like the Mark II or the Mark III, depending on what you think of Metallica. And,
right.
And it led us to records like Death Magnetic, you know what I mean?
Yep. And Hardwired, which I think is a 10 out of 10 Metallica record.
Dude, absolutely. I remember being in South America when Hardwired did just a single drop.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh my God, they're back. Just sitting in the hotel gym, just working out and being like, okay, rewind.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to listen to it like four times in a row.
I feel like it has the, you know, for all of its throwback elements and so on, I feel like it also brought back those Black Album and Load era vocal harmonies, but then put that over, you know, Master Puppets and Injustice for All style stuff. It's just like, it's such a well-rounded, fully fleshed out Metallica record. I love it. And it really begged repeat listens. I think I loved Death Magnetic when it came out, but I didn't find myself going back to it a lot. Whereas I wore Hardwired the fuck out for months.
Yeah, I do think out of the two, I definitely have listened to Hardwired more, but Death Magnetic was just that step where it was like, holy shit, this is what we've been waiting for.
Yeah, Yeah.
Like, it was a step in the right direction where it's like, okay, all right, I can't wait to see what happens.
And while we're talking about the YouTube thing, and I'm actually going to have this guy on the podcast pretty soon. Did you ever see, I want to say it was 2015. I think it's called Saint Anger Revisited. But it's this kid in England who plays guitar, drums, and bass. And he faithfully re-recorded all of Saint Anger, but with, reasonable production.
Like, no way.
You know, inoffensive tones, but the same songs, the same, you know, everything structure-wise. You know, he didn't really edit the songwriting at all. And then he had a friend of his who sounds like Hetfield sing. And then he put the whole thing on YouTube. The whole time you're watching it, it's split into four screens. And so you're watching the same kid and three of them dressed in different outfits, tracking the bass, the drums, and the lead and rhythm guitars. And it's cutting back and forth. And sometimes one screen's blacking out. And then you see the other kid also singing. But it's really cool. And then according to the description of the video, Q Prime got wind of it and ended up giving them the official green light, okay, to have that up. And it got the seal of approval from the band. But yeah, it was making the rounds a few years ago, and I actually found the main kid and asked him to come on the podcast, and he said he will. So that's around the corner.
I have to check that out.
I definitely recommend it. It does give you a whole new take on those songs. You know, hearing them in a way that isn't punching you in the face the whole time.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, and I also became a big fan of the song All Within My Hands via one of those Bridge School, those acoustic shows they do, the Neil Young benefit things. They did an acoustic version of that, maybe 2007, 2008, and I was like, what's this song? I love this song. Wait, this is a Saint Anger song? And it's just in that setting and in that arrangement, it really gets a chance to shine that it didn't quite get on the record.
I can't wait to see them on their Tiny Desk performance if they do one.
Right?
So, yeah. And, oh, man, that Star Spangled Banner was pretty cool, too.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And they just did did it again at an NBA game, right? Like last night.
Yeah. It didn't help, though. Our Raptors won. Yeah. Not to date this podcast.
But... right. We like to be evergreen here. This is 2019. Yeah. They did do, did you ever see the Fallon thing they did with the children's instruments?
No.
It's Metallica, The Roots, and Jimmy Fallon, all of them together playing Inner Sandman on little, like, xylophones and toy pianos and all, like, you know, kiddie instruments.
Okay, that sounds awesome.
It is awesome. And you can tell all the Metallica guys are having fun. And everyone in The Roots and Jimmy is wearing a different Metallica shirt. And then everyone in Metallica is wearing a different Roots or Jimmy Fallon shirt. It's pretty awesome.
That's rad.
Yeah, so last thing while I've got you, the press release from Hopeless for this new record talks about it being the, you know, most aggressive Sum 41 record. Is that accurate? And what can you tell me about that?
Man, as far as the heavy songs, this is the heaviest we've ever gone. I mean, I'm not sure if you've heard the new single, Out for Blood.
That's the only thing I have heard so far.
Yeah, I mean, we've got plans to release two more heavy ones, and then there's a really, really beautiful song that Derek recorded, and it was kind of like a project that he wanted to do and really take care of, and I just think that the job he did on the song was amazing. And I love the heavy stuff, but I'm really excited to see whether or not we do actually go with something lighter on this record as well as a release. Which would be cool, because there are some lighter songs on the album as well. There's some songs that are like strict groove, and then there's some stuff we've never tried before, which I can't wait to hear, and I can't wait to see what people say, because you know, we love it, obviously, because we were a part of it. We had our heads down and really poured everything we have into it. So it's going to be interesting to see what people say. But to me, with this lineup, it's the best thing we've ever done.
I have two all killer, no filler related questions.
Yeah.
The first one is Kerry King. I can only assume that was you. tell me how that happened and anything else about that you remember.
So we did a song on Half Hour Power that ended up being recorded again for the Spider-Man soundtrack.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
right.
They basically came to us. They're like, yo, listen, we're going to do a Spider-Man soundtrack song if you guys want. We're like, yeah, of course. Absolutely. They're like, because the budget is wild, you have your pick of producers. So we were just like, Rick Rubin, hands down. So, dude, we got to work with Rick Rubin, and they were like, yeah, that is a no-brainer.
Not
because
really.
Of the you know, just us rapping in it, and just kind of like the Beastie Boys aspect that and flavor that we wanted to bring.
Yeah,
to it.
And now all of a sudden, No Sleep Till Brooklyn.
Right? Yeah, absolutely. and like his production style was amazing. To put it into terms, if anybody knows how Martin Scorsese directs a film,
mm-hmm.
his input with actors is like, "Do you like what you did? Okay, let's move on."
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And it is up to you to get the performance that you want down on tape. So he talked to me, and I remember.
So the opposite of Stanley Kubrick.
yeah, exactly. Right?
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
So he took some time to like show me around the studio, and the whole time I'm like, you know, this guy is just like one of the most humble dudes. This is amazing. He's like, he explained this this thing he had just gone through where he said, you know, I just went through this kind of psychological treatment that I put myself through where, you know, I moved into a small apartment and all I had was a fridge, a table, a light, and a bed. And that's all I gave myself. And he's like, I had to spend time with myself. I had to learn who I was, learn what I was thinking. And I was just like, whoa, he wasn't afraid to just go deep right away.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm the type of person that eats that up, and I love hearing people's stories. And he's showing me
Amen,
around
by the way.
The studio. Yeah, right? And he's showing me all these pedals. He's showing me this awesome guitar that he said he bought from a guy who used to supply guitars to the Beatles. And then he walks over to the fridge, and it's like, it was like his punchline to the whole thing, right? Like he's like, and I just ended up ordering all of this water for the fridge. I was like, I want an entire fridge filled with Canadian Music water. And for like, it was just lined from the back to the
brilliant
of like Canadian Music water, just this like glacier water bottle that we had never heard of in our entire lives. And there had to be nothing Canadian about it, but it was just so funny to him.
That is what an amazing, interesting character that guy is on so many levels. That's
I
awesome.
Know, right? And then sitting with him in the control room, it was just like I played the lick off the beginning, played the harmony to it, and did the kind of dissonant walk down into the first verse. And he just looked at me and he was like, is that what you want to put on the front? And I was like, yeah, that's what I like. He's like, okay. And I was like, nobody has ever done that to me in the studio before. That's crazy. So, yeah, that's how it ended up being that way. And we were like, yo, we'd love to have Kerry King on this. And he's like, I know Kerry King. So we just got Kerry to throw a solo down on it. And Kerry ended up flying out to Toronto to do the video with us.
Yeah.
And when he showed up, we thought we were so small and intimidated at that point that we were just like, yo, is this guy going to come in? Like, he's going to make fun of us. What's going to happen? Blah, 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 blah. And then he just comes in. He's like, hey, what's up, man? How you guys doing?
He's just normal.
So I hear your new record is going to be Melodic Slayer. Well, fucking bring it. Bring it, dude.
And
we're like, oh, this is awesome. He's like, I'll be right back. I just got something. We just got back from Europe. I brought something back. And we're like, what's he bringing back? Right?
Was it a snake?
He's like, you guys drink booze? We're like, yeah, of course, right? It's us. Yes, we drink booze. He walks to his dressing room, comes back, and we're like, oh shit, he's gonna come out with that fucking gasolina. Like he's gonna torch us up right now. Like it's gonna be fucking heavy. He comes back with this like mint liqueur, right? And whoa, like it just like it didn't strike us
Just nice
that
and
this
gentle.
dude, yeah, right, with the fucking nails sticking
Smooth.
out of his leather bracelet. It's like, oh shit, all right. And then it hit us, and once he brought out the Wimpelmints, the hand got really easy, and just saw him for download, and got to hang out with him and a couple of guys in Anthrax at a bar in Tokyo afterwards.
Oh, amazing. That's amazing.
It was really nice, yeah, man. All those guys, although they have massive bands and they're known for not taking shit, they're good people, man. Like you can actually, they'll take the time and talk to the people that put them in the position they are today.
Yeah, and that's such a good way. And you know what? Now you mentioned that too. That's something I've heard Jason Newsted talk about when he was doing the festival circuit with the Newsted band, how he made sure to take the time to talk to people from younger bands because he remembered how important that was when he was first playing those festivals and meeting his heroes and influences and stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm the one that the fan has to get rid of. It's not vice versa.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned recently hanging out with them in Japan because the reason why I associate that Spider-Man soundtrack song with All Killer is because it was on the Japanese, it was the Japanese bonus track, I believe.
Yes, it was. Yeah, absolutely.
The other thing I was going to ask you related to that record and kind of the last thing, he was I didn't know him super well, but he was definitely a friend and met him a bunch of times and went to his memorial. But Jerry Finn produced
Yeah.
that record. Any particular Jerry Finn stories come to mind or kind of warm recollections of him?
Probably one of my fondest memories of Jerry is the fact that he was so real with you, and he would just tell you exactly what was on his mind. Like that dude was the essence of that friend that could say anything to you. I remember I think we played the Roxy or the Troubadour, one of the two. We had opened up for a bigger band that was headlining really early on, and he came out, and I was so proud of this performance. And I was like, "Yo, Jerry, what'd you think? Like, how's the band?" He's like, "You guys are fucking horrible. You guys are horrible live."
Wow.
Right? I'm
Wow.
like, "Whoa." I'm like, and he's like, you got to work on your guitar tone. I'm like, whoa, like, well, what's wrong with it? He's like, you sound like you're slapping the strings with a mackerel. Right?
My gosh.
I remember just being like, what the fuck? I'm bad? But I needed that person to tell me because I had the ego to go out there and play like I knew what I was doing. But then, like literally the next day, I went out to I think it was a Fry's Electronics, the one with the big UFO in the building, down in Burbank or something like that.
Maybe. I mean, I'm familiar with fries, but I don't, probably. Yeah.
Well, I got myself a Korg PX, I think it might have been a PX3, and it was this thing called the Pandora's Box, and it was like a tiny guitar processor, and you could throw your CD player through it, like your Discman. So I did that, got the cord from the studio, and immediately started practicing, getting tighter. And if it wasn't for that conversation with Jerry Finn, I would not be, whatever you think of my playing, I would not be the guitar player that I am today.
That's amazing, especially
That would be.
when you put that in context with what you said earlier about when bands sometimes reach at that stage in your career where everyone around you is like, "Yeah, this is cool, man. That's great. No, it's fine."
Oh
The
yeah.
difference
Oh
there,
yeah.
you know?
Not Jerry. He had this way of letting you know the truth, no matter how harsh it was, but it always came from a place of love.
Indeed, that's perfectly
Yeah,
said.
man.
Last thing, last thing. I told Derek this.
Yeah.
So I moved a couple of years ago, and I came across during the move my laminate from MTV Icon Metallica, and it's got MTV logo on it. Metallica, it's just like it, yeah, it's awesome. So I posted it on Instagram, and I tagged the Metallica guys in it, and Kirk commented on my Instagram, and he said, "No comment." So my thought there is that he probably shares the opinion with a lot of fans, which was that the Sum 41 medley was awesome, and then a lot of the show was a real head scratcher. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
he better have been telling the truth to me because he said that to me at the bar afterwards.
Oh, well, there you go.
Yeah,
My guess is
man.
correct.
Yeah. He better be telling the truth.
But yeah, I thought you may get a kick out of that as well. It wouldn't be such a fun story if I was talking to maybe somebody else that played the show, but knowing how well you did, it's fun to tell you guys.
Oh, trust me, I remember every moment of Sean Penn's speech. That dude was fucking loaded.
I completely forgot about Sean Penn until
Dude.
just now. Oh my God. That's right, because he's like
Dude.
buddies with Lars. Oh
Yeah,
man.
remember that, like they had to walk his ass out to the middle of the stage because
Yeah.
they're like, yo, this dude is about to fall.
Oh man. And didn't you guys do at the very, very end of the medley, there's a little moment of battery, right? Or am I remembering that wrong? The very,
Oh,
very the way
yeah,
you end
just
Master
yeah,
Mode.
the
Okay,
very end, yeah.
yeah. Sick.
Bat. You got it.
Yeah, a little Easter egg in there for us diehards.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, hit me up anytime if there's ever anything I can do for you, because I like you.
Hey,
So.
same here, man. You got a friend in me?
All right, brother. Take care, man.
All right, buddy. You take care.
Sum 41's re-revisited take on their Metallica medley, which they performed live at the SiriusXM studios, can now be seen on YouTube. And the band's latest studio album, Order in Decline, is available now. Speaking of available now, I also have a new podcast with my buddy Neil Taflinger called Hoosier Illusion, where us two aging punk metalhead parents navigate the messy landscape of our mental health, while occasionally talking about infamous Hoosiers like Johnny Ringo, James Dean, and Axl Rose. Be sure also to check out No Prize from God, which features conversations with creative people about belief, unbelief, and everything between, including some guests that will be of interest to Speak and Destroy listeners. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. You can find Speak and Destroy on Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook, and you can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey, on Instagram at SuperheroHQ, and on Facebook at Ryan J. Downey, RJD. As always, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downing.